body a soft tissue feeds on blood. Someday I'll find you. The urge is here. Ooh.
Nature Boy, I'm Michael, and today's show will be about infectious disease. I think that this is pretty, I don't know, on people's minds right now because of Ebola, so that's why I wanted to do this show at this time. And we'll get to Ebola later on in the show, a little later on. But first, I'm going to talk about what infectious disease is, and kind of what our body does to defend against it, and where we stand right now with Ebola. So, first off, an infection is the invasion of a host organism's body, which would be ours or another animal's, or basically any other organism, by a disease-causing agent, and they multiply, and a organism responds to it, and diseases can produce toxins and cause disease, basically, to us. So there are several different types of infectious agents that can exist. There are viruses, bacteria, other microorganisms, like malaria is one. And that's not either a bacteria or a virus, actually. It's its own type of, I think. Do you know what a malaria is, John? Is it like a amoeboid or?
I think it's amoeboid, yeah. I might be thinking it's a bacteria, but that could be incorrect.
I know it's not a bacteria, but it's a single-celled organism, but it's not technically bacteria.
Okay.
That's all I know. And there's also other infectious diseases like ticks, mites, fleas can be some, fungi can be some, and even things like tapeworms and other things that would persist in our GI tract.
And perhaps the most terrifying are prion diseases, right?
What are those?
Oh, well, that's...
here we go. I see prions.
Yeah. It's like spongiform encephalopathy is the clinical term for mad cow disease. And a prion is just a misfolded protein that can cause other proteins to also misfold. So it persists within your system. And it's usually spread by cannibalism.
That's what mad cow disease is?
Yeah. Spongiform encephalopathy. It's one of the coolest clinical terms, I think. It's like sponge in your head, you know?
So it's kind of like a virus in that it's just like a protein sort of thing, but it doesn't really do anything except cause other proteins to not function well?
And so it can also, in that way it reproduces, and then since it's a protein, it can persist for a really long time, like in decaying animal matter or in the soil.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool. I did not know that.
There we go.
That was a thing. We learn too here on each So what our immune system does, what an immune system to a pathogen does is, there's kind of like two phases to it. There's innate immunity, and then there's like a more active form of immune system, and it's called adaptive immune system in mammals usually. So basically a pathogenic substance will invade a body, a host body, and we have sort of just physical barriers to these organisms. Like our skin has different oils on it, and our cells have, you know, like cell, they have cell membranes that the organisms can't always get past. If they do get past our kind of these physical barriers, then we have what's called innate immunity, and those are just kind of general functions that pretty much every cell has and can kind of deal with some type of pathogenic strain.
And these are the things mediated by like white blood cells and things like that, right?
That actually comes later on. So innate immunity is even more basic.
Oh, I thought we were discussing
that.
Adaptive.
Oh, no. Yeah. So if a pathogen is able to persist past innate immunity, then adaptive immunity kicks in. And so those are where like our specialized cells come in, and they can mount defenses against that. And if that doesn't work, then, you know, then we're in trouble. And a lot of people think that, because we are plant biologists, so I know mostly about plants and their immune responses. A lot of people think that maybe plants don't have an immune system or you know, something that's kind of equivalent to that in what humans have, but they actually do. And it's because every cell basically in a plant can mount a defense to a pathogen, whereas in higher organisms or animals, mammals, stuff like that, we have specialized cells to do that. Whereas in plants, like every cell can become, you know, like a specialized cell.
Well, one of the main issues that plants have, I mean, you could call it an issue, but a major trait of plants is that their cells aren't mobile, whereas we can synthesize new white blood cells or new red blood cells in our right. marrow and transport them throughout our body. It also allows tumor movement, creepy things like that that we don't want, mm-hmm. whereas a plant has to have its own sort of response to that infectious agent.
Yeah, but plants have... they can basically kill their cells in a generalized area, localized like cell death, so that they can, the parasites can't really spread beyond that point where they kill their cells. So there's pluses and minuses, I guess.
Yeah,
different immune responses. So this has been kind of in the news recently because of the Ebola outbreak that's happening in the U.S. And of course, it's only in the news because it got to the U.S. If it was still, you know, in West Africa, then we wouldn't care about it.
There might be a small subset of the population concerned. I don't think we're all so...
I'm talking in general. Yeah, I shouldn't generalize, I guess. But so there's actually a lot of things that we don't even know about the Ebola virus still. It emerged in 1976, so it's kind of a newer pathogen. And... let's see here. I found this article that just came out in the New Yorker, actually, and they talk about all the things that we still don't know about the Ebola virus. So they don't even know the natural reservoir for it, even. They have found it most commonly in fruit bats. That's where it's. That's where people kind of think it comes from, but they don't even know like the animal that hosts it.
Interesting.
Or they call it a natural reservoir. And so it's really hard for them to kind of do research on it because they don't know even what the natural reservoir for it is. So they try to, for instance, do research on mice. That's usually what people use for disease research, but they can't really infect, it doesn't infect mice the same way that it infects humans, so they can't use it for that. And they originally thought that it was in other primates, like chimpanzees, gorillas, and other monkeys, but now they're thinking that it's another animal. And it might be like a bird.
Huh.
So, yeah. So they don't even know that.
Well, that's a major challenge, yeah. Definitely.
Okay, what else do we have?
Hip us to some more Ebola stuff, bro.
Huh?
I'm feeling too up today.
You're feeling too up?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a small break and then talk some more about Ebola to lighten up the mood.
Job that pays a lot, is it this? servicing someone? And is it good to get this man worked up so sad, so sexual? Older dancers gag at what new talent seems to mean. Smaller tits and younger limbs can cause a fit of rivalry. But it is a job, it pays a lot. Is it disservicing someone? And is it good to get these men worked up so sad, so sexual?
All right, and we're back. So more about Ebola. So there's basically a lack of research that's gone into Ebola research recently, and right now it's only really starting to pick up, and the government, I think, is pumping more money into research. I actually just got an email the other day. You guys probably got it too, because we're on the same emailing list, that there was like a call, an NSF call for basically Ebola research.
Yes.
And so I think that really the government only funds things like this when it's a threat to Americans, which brings us into kind of what I wanted to talk about today, which is the pharmaceutical industry and their funding of how they fund certain things and how they don't fund certain things. So basically, I did a project on this in an undergrad bioethics class, and it just kind of stuck with me because this was something that I didn't really know before, but the amount of antibiotics that have been released since the invention of antibiotics 73 years ago is a little over 70 years ago, has decreased year by year. So when antibiotics first came out, there was probably close to 20 new drugs coming out per year. That was like in the 1980s. And if you fast forward to today, in 2012, there was, I think, one new antibiotic agent. So the development of new antibiotics and vaccines is still like declining over time. Meanwhile, the investment to develop one new drug keeps increasing. So in 1979, the cost to develop one new drug was about $100 million. In 2005, it was estimated to be $1.3 billion. And I just found an article today that estimates that new drugs can cost anywhere from $4 billion to $11 billion to bring onto the market. So that's one new drug every year. So when these drugs usually come to the market, they're not usually vaccines or antibiotics. They're usually treatments for chronic diseases like diabetes is a really popular one. And I don't know what else is a chronic disease, like heart disease, mental illness, things like that.
Basically anything that they can, that you have to keep coming back for.
Exactly, right. And because it's not economically advantageous to these pharmaceutical companies to invest so much money and resources into developing vaccines and antibiotic agents, because people need to take them once or for a very short period of time, and that's all they need them for. Whereas if they target chronic diseases, people have to keep buying them. So that's where they invest their money in, because they get the most return. And I found a website that lists like all the new FDA approved drugs for, this is for 2014, and I don't think any of these, I looked through the whole list and there's quite a lot. I just thought that maybe, you know, there's not that many new drugs that come out per year, but there is. There's like, I don't know, at least 100 here on this list. And I don't think any of them are antibiotic or vaccines. They're just, you know, what I see here is maybe in HIV treatment, that's like the closest thing.
If TV is to be believed, there are a lot of new erectile dysfunction products being developed every day, so you can sit next to your wife in separate bathtubs.
Yeah. So that's why I think vaccine, like, I don't know. This is just, it sads me out.
Well, part of it too is the IP laws, right, that are in place now. They facilitate the fact that these companies are going after the chronic issues and not some of the one-hit treatments, because their monopolies don't last as long. So if they're going to put in all this money to go to research and then it has to go through trials, how long did they still maintain their IP before it runs out?
You might say that it's an ailment of our culture that relies on the free market for the development of these sorts of products.
Mm-hmm.
That's very deep, if you guys didn't notice.
Sad today. I'm Nature Boy. And it also takes a really long time to develop a new drug. So there's like a preclinical period that can last anywhere from 3 to 6 years. So they scan thousands of compounds before they even get to any clinical testing. So they can test anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 or even more compounds. And so that's like the discovery phase, and they enter a preclinical trial. So that lasts around 6 years. Then they enter clinical trials, which can last anywhere from 6 to 7 years, the entire process. So that they enter like phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 clinical trials, and each one of those, they need to increase the number of volunteers that they test on. And then after that, it goes into FDA review, which can take another 6 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get one compound, one drug.
Meanwhile, the intellectual property rights that they have, that monopoly, starts day one.
Right.
So that starts running, and all of these pre-trials, and then the other trials, the time that they have for these.
Yeah.
It's minimal.
So development of a new drug can be, you know, anywhere from 15 years to 20 years or longer.
And all the money.
Yeah. All the money that they have to invest in that. Mm-hmm. So it is sad. And malaria is still a big issue too, and we should have a vaccine for that by now also. I found this article today that's talking about a potential vaccine for malaria using a genetically modified viral strain.
Oh.
And I just think that was kind of funny to me, because I thought it's like, you know, the worst dream for these moms that are against vaccines. It's like GMO vaccine altogether in one.
That fits perfectly into the article that I brought for discussion. I'm sure we'll get to you later. Oh, we're trying to segue.
It was supposed to be more natural.
All right, let's do it. The seg is happening right now. Okay, well, so my article that I found, it's just from Science News, which is sort of a pop science periodical that comes out. So this is a sort of a synopsis of a bunch of different research. But the title of the article is Bacterial Healers. And it's all about that genetic modification of bacteria to use those bacteria as treatments for diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the great benefit of these bacteria is that, the ones that they're focusing on now, they infect cells by allowing themselves to be consumed by the cell through endocytosis, which involves the folding in of the cell, of the plasma membrane of the cell, and then that forms a vesicle, which is drawn into the cell body. Now, most of the time this works just fine, and the cell sequesters off the bacteria or the infectious agent, and then dumps a bunch of toxins in there and then kills it. But with these bacteria, they have a protein that can lyse that vacuole or vesicle and releases themselves back into the cell. So this particular bacteria, it's from the genus Listeria. And it's a causative agent of, I think, dysentery.
Listeria, where is that? Are a lot of them found in your mouth? Is that why this Listerine is called?
I'm not sure. I am not sure. But
what is Listerine named after? Is it a guy named Lister?
I have no idea. I think that Google might have some answers.
I'm trying to remember. This is vaguely familiar from like an introductory bio class or chem class. Anyway, you can go on.
Maybe it was originally a treatment for Listeria.
Joseph Lister.
His name was Lister.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. So.
Now that that's settled, yeah.
So what they do is they, through genetic engineering, they remove the protein that actually leads to the damaging of the cells, and they replace that protein with a variety of things. It can be a specially targeted chemical, or one of the more interesting applications I saw was the attachment of radioactive isotopes to these bacteria. So the bacteria actually enters the cell and then persists for a while, and it's emitting radiation. And since these cancer cells, this is a cancer treatment now, and since these cancer cells profligate in the same area usually, it leads to localized cell death and it's the same isotope that's used in conventional radiotherapies for cancer. So it's just really interesting. It's a targeted way. It's super targeted. You know, it takes directly to the cells because they also allow the cell to recognize specifically those.
What kind of disease did they use this for? Is it, was it cancer?
This was for cancer.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah, it was for pancreatic cancer. And this one company, Arduro, that does cancer treatments, now they said that 10% of their patients over the last year have been on this treatment, and it just got fast-tracked by the FDA. So soon it'll be used just everywhere. We'll be seeing a lot more of it if things, you know.
How do you fast-track something on the FDA?
I am not sure. As I said, it's science news, so they don't go too in-depth at that sort of thing. So there's a few other bacteria they use. They've also been modifying the flesh-eating bacteria to try to use that to dissolve, like, digest tumors, which is a really interesting idea.
That is really interesting.
Yeah.
Do they comment at all, like, on what public perception of this might be?
They do talk about that. They say, you know, we'll have to test a lot more. It'll require more testing just because they need to have more research to back the inevitable backlash to introduction of genetically modified bacteria into your body.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't want to eat, GM corn.
You have a living bacteria.
Yeah, treatment going on inside of you.
And the woman that they claim was successfully treated by the, I did air quotes there, for the listening audience, that was successfully treated by the flesh-eating bacteria. She also developed like a cyst in the center of the tumor that dissolved, and she got a fever and she started to get really ill, and then she died of another form of cancer before they could see what the effects of the bacteria would be. So,
oh my God. Yeah.
I wouldn't call it a rousing success exactly. I wanted to cram in two articles, if that's okay with you guys.
Sure.
All right, cool. So the other one, this one I was really excited about. I just learned about this researching for the show. It's a disease called encephalitis lethargica.
Okay.
So, you know, it's like sleepy in your head, basically. It's also called sleepy sickness. And this was occurring, there were cases recorded in the late 1800s in Italy. And then in the early 1900s, it sort of became an epidemic. It spread through Austria and some other place out there, and then eventually made its way to London. And it affected about, over the course of 1917 to 1930, when it was really in the pandemic stage, it affected somewhere between 500,000 to 1,000,000 people. And mortality rates ranged from 30 to 50% over those years.
Wait, people died from this?
People died from this.
From being sleepy?
From being sleepy. Now, it had a range of effects. It would usually lead to this semi-comatose state that would last for days to weeks to months, where the patient would seem completely unconscious for this entire time and would be aware of what was going on around them. So that's extra terrifying. You can imagine some horrible situations there. During later stages, the same disease caused really, really abnormal behaviors, especially in children. And children were found to become super hyperactive and aggressive. One girl removed her own eyeballs and some of her teeth.
What the heck?
Under the impetus of this disease. it affects your hypothalamus. There's actually a physical change that occurs inside of your brain, and brain tissue that was transferred from an infected individual to a chimp was shown to infect that chimp. So it's an infectious disease.
It's bacterial?
This is the big kicker. It was never determined what the causative agent of this disease was. There are cases recorded as late as 2006. There was a recent study in 2012, I think, where this was the most recent research into it, and they linked it to some virus. They found viral particles or remnants that were in a lot of these preserved samples, but they don't know what the virus is. And there have been a lot of theories over the years about what causes this. Somebody died in the late 90s of this disease. Usually what causes death is a lack of respiration. You enter that comatose state and you just don't breathe enough. And in the modern age, we have respirator technology, which is so much more advanced than in the early 1900s, mm-hmm. that can be used to usually treat people until they exit this disease. But after you emerge from the semi-comatose phase of the infection, you can develop Parkinson's.
Oh, wow.
It's very likely that you'll get Parkinson's.
Develop Parkinson's after you enter into coma?
Yeah, so you come out of your disease and you think that you're doing better, and then all of a sudden that hits you.
So these are for individuals that have recovered.
Yeah. The virus still, if it's virus.
And so they don't really know. It's been set back a lot by, 1917 to 1930, there was a Spanish flu epidemic in 1918, and then there was World War I, and so a lot of funding got transferred. J.P. Morgan, one of the J.P. Morgans, he was the son of the original J.P. Morgan, his wife died of this disease, and he funded a lot of research into it, but that funding also eventually ran out. So it's out there, encephalitis lethargica.
I had no idea about this disease. And what are like the symptoms of it? Do people exhibit anything before they enter into coma?
I think that the closest thing was like a fever, a low fever. It's not something
flu-like symptoms.
Flu-like symptoms.
And then you just have Ebola. It's like, it has flu-like symptoms.
Before. Yeah.
A hangover has flu-like symptoms. You know, you never know what's...
Right. They also don't even know like how Ebola is transmitted. They know that it's through, you know, like bodily fluids, right. But they're not sure of the exact cause of transfer.
Well,
like,
some of the reading that I was reading.
Uh-huh. Are you proud of that sentence, Marshall?
No, some of the materials that I was reading said that women who are breastfeeding, they're not sure if they can ever return to breastfeeding their child after they've been infected, if they come out of it.
And with also, Ebola?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, with Ebola. And also with Ebola, it can be transferred in the semen for up to something like 7 weeks. Okay. So
7 weeks after they're cured? Or
yeah,
okay.
After they come out.
Wow.
So, yeah, so this also adds a whole other dynamic to the issue that's going on.
Yeah.
So, because you can't really have contact with other individuals also because you are still infectious. You're still carrying the virus.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot that they still don't know about Ebola, which is probably the scariest thing about it.
Well,
how little they know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
And I think if it was a disease that started here, then we would have a cure for it, but...
Well, they kind of have already adapted one based off of the antibodies from survivors.
So okay. Yeah, there are certain people that just seem to be immune to it, right?
Yeah.
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 I did find, well, maybe we should take a little break and then we can talk about Ebola some more.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Okay.
That thirst I can teach you. Say you're lonely. say you want me. I say you live without it. Unless you're the only one who instigates. Get your mouth open, your heart.
So you're listening to Nature Boy on K-Chung Radio again, if you forgot. I'm Michael, and then we are joined by John and Marshall. So Marshall is going to talk about... Tell them, Marshall.
Did you already forget the name?
No, I know what it is.
Okay. This one is a little more plant-related, obviously. It's Huan Long Bing, and
so maybe why don't you reintroduce yourself to the people...
Okay, I'm Marshall.
And you actually, what is your research on? You actually work with mostly plant disease.
Yeah, so I work in a plant pathology lab, so we study infectious diseases in plants. My major professor, the professor I study under, she actually helped create a treatment for this citrus greening. And what it is it's a phloem-restricted gram-negative bacteria.
Phloem is the vascular tissue of plants,
right.
Veins.
Right.
It carries sugars and other
products of photosynthesis.
Yeah.
Photosynthetics. So this is bacteria that stays in the plant's vascular tissue. And also gram-negative bacteria, if anybody doesn't know.
Whoa, bro.
There aren't as many antibiotic treatments for gram-negative bacteria because they don't have the same cell wall that gram-positive bacteria have.
And right.
That's usually how we disrupt bacteria.
So this is kind of why... what are some other like gram-negative diseases in humans? Maybe an example is Staphylococcus aureus.
Oh, that's good.
So there's methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, and that's MRSA for short.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it's so difficult to treat is because it's a gram-negative bacteria, and they don't have the same type of cell wall that gram-positive bacteria do, and that's usually what antibiotic treatments target is it's a protein called peptidoglycan in gram-positive bacteria. And they have gram-positive and gram-negative. Basically, bacteria gets divided into two subclasses this way, and the gram-positive ones have a thicker cell wall. And they're supposed to be, I guess, party or in the environment, but gram-negative bacteria kind of persist in, they do better like in hosts and things like that. Yeah, so.
Like us. Yeah.
Or like plants,
like the citrus greening, Huanlong Bing. So, and this is a pretty devastating bacteria. In the US alone, it's estimated that Huanlong Bing expenses now total $1.2 billion, and that was as of 2011. So the cost of producing citrus increased by 50% in a lot of infected areas, and that's particularly true in Florida because that's where most of these infections are in the United States.
Yeah, and it's funny because we took a class with your professor together, and she would always talk crap about Florida's citrus industry versus California's. So, I mean, citrus is a huge industry.
It's huge.
Yeah, and Huanlong Bing has kind of infected pretty much all the plants that are in Florida.
Yeah.
But she was like, oh, it doesn't really matter that much because all the Florida's oranges are crappy and they use them for juice.
Well, yeah.
Whereas California, the oranges from California, people buy the whole fruit, so it needs to look pretty and taste pretty.
Well, here the environment is a little different. So yeah, in Florida there's a lot more humidity, so it's not quite the ideal situation for certain types of plants to be grown in, but yet they still have extremely fertile soils. So that's still where a lot of agriculture goes, even if it's not the best environment. California is much more arid, but we still have those rich soils, so it makes it good for showy plant products that we eat, like oranges. But yeah, a lot of the canning fruits come from Florida.
Right.
Yeah. So they were having this issue in the United States, and my professor helped identify what was going on, specifically using a panel of RNAs, small RNAs, to find that a small RNA associated with phosphorus deficiency or deficit in the plant was an issue. So what they did, because it's a gram-negative bacteria and it's phloem-restricted, it's extremely hard to treat this bacteria. You only know, you can't project where the bacteria is going to strike on your crops. So once you find it, the plants are already infected and probably transmitting this infection to other plants. So when they find this infection, they typically will burn it out if it's really small,
because
that's the only treatment that really exists right now. Or what they'll do if they know the entire crop is already infected is just treat the symptoms. So what that is phosphorus deficit.
Right.
So these plants typically, if they're infected, die slowly.
It takes kind of like several years for the fruit to actually start turning green and then becoming unusable.
Right, but I mean, if anybody knows about setting up citrus producing fields, that also takes a very long time too.
Yeah.
I mean, was it like 5 years before you start getting fruit?
I think it depends if they grow like a tree from a seed, which they typically don't do.
Right.
But if that is the case, and it takes around like 7 years for the first fruit to start showing up. If they graft them, which is more typical,
right?
So they use a better root and a scion, which is the top, the part that goes on the top, then I think they can get fruit in like 5 years or so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is actually a conversation that I had with somebody who's not a scientist. He has like an orange tree in his backyard, and he was talking to me because he heard about HLB or Huanlong Bing in the news, I guess. And he was concerned that maybe his tree might have it. And I was like, well, you can add phosphorus to it. And that's something that I learned from your
So the treatment is burn the tree out of his yard or give it phosphorus and it'll continue to produce for as long as that crop is good. So I'm not quite sure how long they leave orange trees to produce.
Yeah.
But you can just continue to treat the trees, and then you'll still be able to produce your cash crops, so you'll still get your return on your investment there.
So now, did your professor find this method of treatment, or did she investigate more the causative agent?
No, so it's more of the treatment.
Oh.
So yeah, by using small RNA panels, she found that the small RNA that was coming back was associated with phosphorus deficiency in other plants.
Oh, so, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So then they were able to help the
So Florida is the research that you do applicable to HLB, or what is your
my particular research is not I mean, it's still infectious disease, but it's not HLB. So mine is more of the regulation of the RNAi machinery. So.
Okay, so it's more like more basic research.
Yeah, and more fundamental, more applicable.
He just roasted you, bro.
No, well,
no. this basic, is research that needs to happen. That has
basic. I think very different connotations in science than it does to, like, you know, if you call somebody a basic bitch.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow. We do a lot.
You know, NSF might actually listen to these.
That's a turn of death. And we don't have regular FCC regulations, that we can say things like that.
And NSF is full of basic bitches.
That was John Montgomery, by the way. That was John Montgomery.
Fund my research. Turf grass drought tolerance. No, you guys love it.
It's so extremely necessary. We need more turf.
So,
Marshall.
So basic research, what that is it's like more fun.
More fun, yeah.
Yeah, fun.
More no, fundamental.
More fundamental biology research that we need to be able to apply to applied research. So those are the two divisions in research. There's basic and applied. And me and John fall into the applied category, I would argue. And
I would support you in that argument.
Yes, and Marshall's definitely more basic.
I really don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, molecular biology is a hard science versus touchy-feely biology.
Oh.
It's not touchy-feely. Okay, was that the article that you brought in, the HLB one?
Yeah, I brought in Huan Long Bing. Also, I have a listing of...
Was there more from that article that you wanted to...
No, I mean, emphasize? I think a lot of people don't realize some of the issues that are coming up in the future that a lot of us plant biologists are trying to fix, because there's also going to become a food shortage or a food resource issue in the near future. And so something like Huan Long Bing, which can increase the cost of producing citrus by 50%, is huge. Extremely huge for what that means for the future of food production. So,
does HLB infect all different types of citrus?
Yeah.
Or is it just oranges? Because there's so much diversity. And so I would think that, you know, maybe people who are against monocultures, they would kind of, this would be kind of like a kind of a poster for, or I don't know, like, you know, a champion for their cause. Mm-hmm. In terms of being against monoculture,
downfall of monoculture.
Yeah, but this infects.
I think it, this all is different types all of citrus. Right? I mean, here in the article, it says that some citrus relatives, some of its hybrids are used as rootstock, and they have observed some tolerance. But so that makes me think that this is just citrus related and not orange specific.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But sweet oranges were the target of this research.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the different varieties of citrus, they're not that diverged, right? Isn't it mostly?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They do have different, like, species, though. There's, like, actually different... There's not, like, one citrus species in the world.
Oh, yeah.
But what is a species?
Oh, hey, next episode. The species concept.
Okay. That's another show. We're going to take another music break. Thank you. finish off the show with talking about Ebola again, because it's so popular.
Uh-oh. Such a rage.
Oh, wow.
Stop that. Okay.
Are we still on?
Huh?
We're on?
Yeah, we're on. Yeah. there was this article that I wanted to get access to, but it's apparently too new. They have published like a little abstract or synopsis for it, but I haven't actually published the entire article yet. And it's in Science, the latest issue of Science, and it says here October 30th, but I still don't have access to it. I don't know why. And I am connected to our school's infrastructure, but still I can't get it. But basically they were saying that the genetic diversity of the host basically is what contributes the most to resistance for the disease right now. So they were trying to use mice to model this disease to try to learn more about it. But like I mentioned earlier, it doesn't really affect mice the same way that it infects humans. And so they were infecting mice with basically these human strains, or what they found in humans, and it wasn't doing anything to the mice, so they weren't producing any symptoms.
Because rodents don't show symptoms.
Yeah, they don't show any symptoms to the Ebola virus. Well, but what was crazy that a virus started to mutate, I guess, and then some of the mice were becoming... they were starting to show symptoms.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's hemorrhagic fever and diarrhea and all those other symptoms associated with Ebola. Yeah, I know. So based on these results, they were saying that it actually caused 100% mortality when the disease mutated in the mice.
Oh, wow.
Cool. And I think the most virulent strain of the disease right now it's about a 90% mortality rate, so it's actually, it's very severe. But basically what this was telling them was that right now the kind of biggest enabler of resistance is genetic diversity.
Right. IFL Science also just put out an article.
And what does IFL stand for? What is that? It's a website.
It is a website. You can just type in IFLScience.com and go to... They're kind of like a science blog, and they have put out a number of articles recently on Ebola. And one of them was about how genetic diversity, your genes dictate whether or not you will die from the disease.
Right.
So
What did you mention earlier about... kind of them trying to use resistant people as a model? What are they doing?
So they're trying to use blood treatments from people who have already had the disease and carry the antibodies to the virus.
So they basically, do they do blood transfusions for people who are sick? Or?
I mean, I'm not recalling 100% of the information from this article, but I think for just to keep it really basic, it's basically blood transfusions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Isn't that a treatment that they're doing right now for Ebola?
Yeah,
it is. Yeah, it's been effective in some cases.
And are they using, do either of you know if they're using people that are known to be resistant, or they just transfuse any...
My understanding is anybody who's made it through the disease.
Oh, so it has,
they have the antibodies.
So they had to have had the disease and...
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And everybody has to.
Like a priming effect for other people.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, the mode of transmission is still not really known.
Have we talked about the symptom? Like, how you die from Ebola?
No, we haven't. No. Do you know all the symptoms of Ebola?
I mean...
I read an article that was basically just flu-like symptoms, but then they become more severe, and they start... You know.
Well, it starts as a flu-like symptom, but then it attacks your kidneys and keeps your... You basically die of dehydration because of all the liquid loss, but also diarrhea. Too...
Do you poo blood with Ebola?
Yeah, mucous membranes, any and all of your mucous membranes can start to leak blood. So, nose, ears, eyes.
What a tumor.
Eyes?
Mouth.
What? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's crazy.
You can see blood in the whites of your eyes, just... Ugh.
That's crazy.
Halloween costumes would be really easy.
Oh my gosh.
You're ready to go. Red eyes, come on.
It's extremely appropriate.
You guys aren't giving me anything.
If anybody didn't know, John is also a stand-up comedian.
Yeah. That's not true.
You know, he...
you can catch him at appearances at UCB Theater.
Yes, every, that's true. Every so often. That's true. Yeah.
These are erroneous claims by an improv comedian. Okay.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Improv. Sometimes it doesn't work, sometimes it does, and it didn't work this time. But, anyway...
You guys loved it.
That's how you die is from...
That's how you die on stage.
Yeah. And also from Ebola is so lots of liquids. So
yeah, and I wonder why they, like people who are receiving hospital treatments and they have like these IVs that keep them hydrated, I wonder why that's still not...
I mean, your kidneys are doing more than just keeping that.
So it causes kidney failure?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, they could just put you on dialysis if that was really the issue. There's a number of other things happening here, but mm-hmm. yeah. They have to keep you from dehydrating as all of the liquids gush from every single orifice mucous membrane in your body. So
my take-home message
for this... I want a gusher right now.
Oh, my God. Oh, those are good candies.
Great.
But my take-home message for this show is that more money needs to be invested into science, and don't be afraid of vaccines. That's silly. And we can talk about it on another show, but...
Yeah.
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 We record Nature Boy live from Kaecheung Radio in Chinatown, and it's broadcasting live on 1630 AM. But you can also catch archives of it on kaecheungradio.org, and we post a podcast to iTunes, so you can find it that way as well.
Yeah, about 2 weeks after each broadcast, the podcast gets posted, and you can find it by searching for Nature Boy the podcast. If you guys don't mind, I wanted to fit in one plug here.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, this is just a film that I think everybody should be aware of. Mm-hmm. And I've brought copies for you guys because it's out of print. So you can back me up on this next show after you watch and love this movie.
Oh, wow.
It's the 1994 classic, Twin Sitters. It stars David Paul and Peter Paul, the barbarian brothers of WWE fame. And they're twins, twin brothers, they're very muscular, and they babysit a pair of twins who are very rambunctious and ill-behaved, and it's a fantastic movie. I think everyone should know about it. I just want to get the word out.
Okay.
Oh, that's nice.
Ebola. Yeah.
Okay, and that's it for our show. Thanks for listening.